You've likely heard it said that truth is stranger than fiction, and few cases make that as apparent as the tale of Daniel LaPlante. As bizarre as it sounds, a 17-year-old Daniel became obsessed with a girl he knew and hid in the wall of her home for 9 months, and would later go on to murder 3 people. The details of this entire case are nearly too shocking to be believed. Now, this story is so notorious within criminal history that it has become a sort of urban legend. Since the 1980s, it has been passed around and retold so many times that a lot of people have trouble keeping the facts straight. Because as you can imagine, the radical elements of the case make it a hotbed for rumors. While researching this case, I found that newspapers from the time would give 3 different versions of the same event, and some documentaries would flat out make up names for the people involved. So I decided to reach out to a man who is a reliable source for this case, that man being Joe Turner. Joe Turner wrote a book for this case that is yet to come out, as it is coinciding with the release of a documentary. As it turns out, when Joe began writing this book, he got first-hand accounts from nearly everyone involved with the case, and was able to put together a cohesive narrative with first-hand accounts. And after I made contact with him, he has been incredibly helpful in helping me piece out a correct timeline, as well as getting some facts straight. So check him out at joeturnerbooks.com and be sure to get a copy of his book regarding this case when it comes out, because he's really cool and I appreciate him. Also want to mention, a lot of the details of this case are pretty gnarly, from things like extreme stalking to, again, a triple homicide, so viewer discretion is advised. And the other thing I want to advise you on is my shameless merch plug, because the Camp Wendigoon collection with the t-shirt, squonk plush, pants, and hat are only going to be available for a few more days, so get them while you can. Today's topic has so many developments that are hard to believe, so if that sounds interesting to you, stick around after the ad as we break down the fact and fiction of the boy in the wall.
While you probably don't have anyone watching you from inside of your walls, you almost certainly have someone trying to watch you online. There's a high likelihood that there's someone watching your devices, your bank accounts, maybe even your social security number. That's because there's so many data breaches every year, and most of the time we don't know for months until after they happen. Take Bank of America, for example, who just announced a data breach that happened over 90 days ago. On average, it takes a company 277 days to report a breach. Your bank could be breached right now, and you could be months away from learning about it. You don't want to give a criminal a 9-month head start, but that's where today's sponsor, Aura, is here to help. Aura constantly scans the dark web, breach databases, and even shady data brokers that buy and sell your information, looking for your personal details, like your phone number, social security number, or email. They're going to send you an instant alert if anyone tries to use this information to access your credit or bank accounts. Not only that, but they give me up to $5 million in identity theft insurance should the worst happen. That's peace of mind you won't get from just checking your credit score every now and then. But Aura isn't just about monitoring data breaches and ID theft. They bundle a VPN to keep your browsing private, scam call protection to stop those fake IRS or car warranty calls, and real-time transaction monitoring to help spot fraud before it drains your account. They even let you remove your info from those creepy data broker websites that love to collect and sell your personal details. Instead of juggling a bunch of different security tools, Aura gives you everything you need in one place. And right now, there's never been a better time to get in on this offer. Because right now, if you head to the link below at aura.com/wendigoon, you can try Aura for 14 days absolutely free. There'll be enough time for Aura to find out if any of your personal data has been exposed. You'll learn about it before one of these companies are forced to notify you. So quit looking over your shoulder and be sure that you're safe online. Again, that's 2 weeks of Aura for free at aura.com/wendigoon to get in on this incredible offer today. Thank you all for watching the ad, and thank you to Aura for sponsoring the channel. We are now back to the video.
We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. Daniel LaPlante was born May the 15th of 1970 in Townsend, Massachusetts. And from there, the troubles began. Daniel was born to Claude and Elaine LaPlante, and to say that their marriage was troubled would be an understatement. Claude seemed to be a violent man, and by the time Daniel was 2 years old, Claude began to abuse Daniel. Claude would often yell at or hit the child, and according to some sources, was convinced that the child wasn't even his. In 1974, when Daniel was only 4 years old, his father would go to jail for raping a woman. After Claude got out of jail, Elaine would stay married to him for about a year after. And a lot of people look really harshly on Elaine for this, but you also have to imagine if the abuse was that intense, Elaine was probably afraid of her husband to some extent. Eventually, Elaine went to live with her sister and then filed for divorce from Claude, but Claude tried to take full custody of the children. However, given his violent felony, that didn't go over too well with the judge, and on November 4th of 1977, Elaine was granted full custody of Daniel and his siblings. From here, Elaine would go on to remarry a man named David Moore, and the violence in the house would finally cease. That is, until Daniel got a little older. At first, Daniel's issue seemed to be typical of a kid who came from a rough home. He had trouble in school, seemed aggressive towards classmates, but as he got older, these problems became more severe. By the time Daniel got to high school, he had to transfer schools constantly. This was due to him failing classes, skipping school, and his behavioral issues. Years later, friends of Daniel's would say that by the time Daniel was 12 years old, he was already robbing stores. Now, mind you, these were never robberies where he had a gun or threatened anyone outright or anything that could get him in trouble with the law explicitly. But from a young age, the police suspected him and could just never prove anything. As a matter of fact, we didn't know these for sure until the friends that he robbed the stores with would tell people years later. Those same friends would later say that when Daniel was a young teenager, he would do things like torture small animals or commit acts of arson. And for a long time, Daniel was able to keep these tendencies of his hidden, at least for the most part. Those who knew him passively say that he gave off a menacing tone. And while some of these things are understandable for, you know, guys in high school, things like heavy metal or scary movies, other things like bringing porn magazines everywhere he went, or being really into Nazi memorabilia, raised a few red flags. While bouncing from school to school, Daniel would eventually see a psychiatrist while attending St. Bernard High School. This psychiatrist would be the first time that Daniel was really examined. And there he was diagnosed with some learning disabilities like dyslexia and ADD.
I want to double check that I was right about this part before I misspoke. He wasn't diagnosed with ADD per se. It was the 1980s, so he was diagnosed with hyperactivity, which the modern equivalent of that is ADHD. But in the 1980s, hyperactivity was also kind of an umbrella term for a lot of behavioral issues that people, especially children, would have. So when he was 15, he was formally diagnosed with hyperactivity and dyslexia. Other than that, and eventually being found fit to stand trial, those are the only diagnoses that Daniel would ever have. That being said, in the years following this case, several of the psychiatrists who worked with Daniel would say that he most likely has a Cluster B personality disorder. And again, while this isn't an official diagnosis by any means, this tends to be the common through line that a lot of doctors say and also makes the most sense given the case. The four main Cluster B personality disorders are antisocial personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and histrionic personality disorder, with most people saying that Daniel tends to lean towards the borderline personality disorder, or BPD. Untreated BPD will often lead to symptoms like impulsiveness, risk-seeking behavior, sudden outbursts of violence, all things that will become apparent through this case. While borderline personality disorder is most often attributed to one's environment, there is a lot of research to indicate that it is at least partially genetic as well. And given Daniel's biological father's behavior, that would make sense.
And it's here we hit our first major point of contention in this story. Daniel would later go on to say, and this would be widely circulated by press at the time, as well as articles that would follow for decades. Daniel has stated that he was sexually abused by his birth father, his stepfather, and his psychiatrist. And in the majority of sources you'll read, this is presented as fact. However, these allegations have never had any evidence or even been stated by anyone originally other than Daniel. Now, his birth father can be more believable. We know from his siblings and family that Daniel's birth father was physically abusive and verbally abusive. And while Daniel's family says that his birth father was never sexually abusive, given what his father would later be charged for, that's not outside of the realm of possibility. However, given Daniel's habits of lying and violence and causing trouble, we can't really call him a reliable witness. Because other than his own account, there's never been allegations, to my knowledge, made about his stepfather or the psychiatrist. So that begs the question, why then is this account so widely reported? And I think it's because it makes sense, or at least feels better, if Daniel had some reason to do the things he would later do. Not a justification by any means, but at least an explanation as to where the evil came from. I mean, how many times have we heard stories of people who grow up to become deviants or criminals only became that way because of things that happened to them? And while yes, Daniel seemed to have a very negative influence in his life at an early age due to his abusive father, it doesn't seem that this negative influence occurred throughout the rest of Daniel's life leading up to his crimes, as he would want people to believe. And a lot of people try to group violent mental conditions like this into two camps. Either you're born with it and you're simply broken forever, and that person's just going to be a bad egg, or this person had a lot of trauma throughout their life, and that's the reason that they're the way they are. And I think Daniel, at least in my unqualified opinion, falls into a sort of gray area down the middle. There are plenty of people who are diagnosed with the scary mental conditions from a very early age, things like psychopathy or sociopathy, who go on to live peaceful, nonviolent lives because of the guidance they have around them. Sure, living without impulses like empathy can be very difficult, but if you have a network of people around you who want to help you, those people can succeed. And people who are subjected to heavy amounts of abuse and evil are not predestined to become that same evil. However, Daniel seems to have fallen in the worst camp of both options. If the diagnosis is correct, he was born with a condition that it would take a lot of labor and love to pull him out of. And in contrast, he was born to a physically abusive father. I don't believe Daniel to have been cursed from birth. I think there certainly might have been an option with the correct direction for him to live a peaceful, happy life. But instead, a violent influence accelerated any condition he already had. I'm of course not arguing that Daniel wasn't responsible for the actions he would later do. I agree with the court's ruling that he was fully knowledgeable about the wickedness of the crimes he would eventually commit. But what I am saying is that his diagnosis, along with this early influence, was a recipe for disaster, as everyone else would soon find. The first signs of what Daniel would go on to do came in how he treated women. Daniel seemed to have a habit of groping girls in public, either girls at his school or girls out at restaurants. It's kind of insane to just casually say that, because I feel like if that kind of thing happened today, it would immediately become a problem. But I guess in the 1980s, it was like, boys will be boys. He's not smoking weed, is he? If something this heinous is what Daniel was doing in public, then as you could imagine, it was much worse in private. Daniel had a friend, and at his friend's house, they would regularly invite over girls and assault them. The details on this are murky. I imagine alcohol or drugs was used to some degree. As far as we know, according to Joe Turner, only one girl ever went to the police with this. This victim was invited to the friend's house, went there and was assaulted, and then went to the police, who went so far as to search the house itself. But according to her, despite being in the room where the assault happened, the police didn't do anything about it, stating that it was effectively her word against theirs, and Daniel never got in trouble for this. Again, the police probably just showed up, made sure there wasn't weed, and then left. Around 1985, at the age of 15, Daniel developed the disturbing habit of breaking into people's homes. Sometimes he would steal things, other times he would move things around, and sometimes he would just stand there. Daniel seemed to have a fascination with other infamous criminals, one of them being Charles Manson. And Charles Manson would have his followers break into people's homes to get them comfortable with the act of breaking into people's homes. So maybe Daniel took inspiration from that. Getting in and out of people's houses unseen became a regular occurrence for him, something that he got really good at. In 1986, Daniel, now 16 years old, would kick off the series of events that he is now most known for. And it all began when he developed an infatuation with a 15-year-old Tina Bowen. In 1986, Tina Bowen was 15 years old and lived with her two younger sisters, Karen and Kathy, and lived in a single-parent household with her father, Frank, as her mother, Ruth, had recently died of cancer. Now, we're not exactly sure how Daniel picked Tina as a target. It's been said that Tina had a habit of writing down her phone number and handing them out to boys in town, so it's most likely that Daniel saw her at some point and managed to get a hold of this phone number. So one night, Daniel calls her and the two begin talking. See, Daniel and Tina went to different schools, so Daniel uses his real name but describes himself as a tall, athletic, blonde-haired guy who's academic and interested in her. After a few phone conversations, the two plan a date. However, when the night of this date arrives, Tina realizes that she's been catfished. Daniel comes to her house to take her on a date. By most accounts I've read, it's to go to a fair that was in Townsend. And when Daniel arrives, Tina sees that he is not at all like the person he described on the phone. Now, while it is certainly true that Daniel catfished about his appearance, some sources will take this detail a bit too far. A lot of sources you'll read will describe Daniel as being overweight and out of shape and generally hideous. But despite his unwelcoming demeanor, Daniel played track and football throughout high school, despite jumping from school to school frequently. He had an athletic build and potential to be attractive, he just didn't take care of himself. He was said to wash infrequently and smell constantly. Friends of his would later say that he would wear the same clothes over and over again, so he would go to football practice and get a shirt sweaty, and then the next day just put the same shirt back on. Because of this, he had greasy hair, an acne-ridden face, but due to his athletics, this was combined with a competent build, pointing to the fact that Daniel probably could have got the female attention he was looking for if he put any effort into it, and you know, wasn't evil. So Tina, despite her apprehensions, decides to go on this date with Daniel. She would later say that it was really weird because Daniel was obsessed with the thought of Tina's dead mother. As soon as Daniel found out that Tina's mother was dead, he just kept asking questions about how much she suffered, how Tina felt watching her die, what it's like to have a dead parent. Tina was, as you could imagine, generally creeped out by this and decided to leave the date early. Now, a lot of accounts say that this is the last time Tina ever spoke to Daniel, but according to Tina, they saw each other a couple of times after this. There was at least one instance of her father taking the two of them to the movies, and one occasion of Daniel coming over for a family dinner. It seems that although Tina was no longer interested in him, she tried to maintain a friendship with him, most likely because she felt bad for him, because as far as Tina knows, this guy's just an outcast who has trouble making friends. But it seems he was even off-putting in the friend zone, so she pushed him out of even that and began to break contact. But little did Tina know that the damage had already been done. Some months later, in January of 1986, Tina and her two sisters decided to have a séance. Now, I know that probably sounds out of nowhere, but you've got to understand, in the 1980s, girls couldn't stare at TikTok for 6 hours. So a lot of high school girls would just do whatever was trendy at the time, or whatever the in moment was.
Hey, me again on the editor side. So it turns out this seance wasn't in January of 1986. The first instance that the Bowen girls had that was suspicious was in March of 1986, and the seance happened sometime over the summer. But they all kind of like snowballed off of each other. But regardless, the first instance was in March, not January. I guess whoever said January made it up. Could have been me. Who knows?
And in the 1980s, it was the height of horror movies and the satanic panic. Stories of Ouija boards and contacting the supernatural were all the rage. So Tina and her sisters decide to light some candles and have a seance to see if they can contact their mom. That night, as they're asking questions, according to the sisters, they heard knocking coming from the walls. According to them, they would ask a question and then hear knocking in answer to that question, leading the girls to freak out and believe that they had, in fact, summoned the spirit of their mother. And even as they blew out the candles and went to bed, they said that they could hear knocking in the wall through the night. But as the days went on, the knocking didn't stop. As a matter of fact, the knocking in the walls got to be so much that it would regularly keep the girls up at night. And after this, strange things would continue to happen. The girls would leave a room and come back later to find that the furniture had been moved, that pictures had been knocked off the wall. Their clothes would be moved around their bedroom, things pulled out of drawers. Because of this, the girls believed that the house was haunted, and that instead of contacting their mother, they had in fact contacted a demon. They told their father about this, and Frank, as any father would, just assumed that the girls had an active imagination. I mean, think about it. The girls had just lost their mother, and then had tried a seance, and then said that the house was haunted, and everything that's happened in the house so far can be chalked up to girls playing a sort of practical joke on each other. I certainly can't fault Frank for dismissing this as just that. This went on for several months. The girls had several bizarre instances. One night, one of the girls woke up and said that breadcrumbs were sprinkled on her face. Other bizarre things would happen, like at one point they found their mother's wedding dress laid across a bed. At one point they found a trail of pennies leading down the staircase. They woke up one day to find that someone had peed in the bathtub. At one point, the girls went into the basement of the home and found the words, "I'm in your room, come and find me," written on the wall in shaving foam. A few weeks later, Tina would find another message in shaving foam that said, "I'm back. Find me if you can." Frank wasn't home for the second occasion, so Tina ran to the nearby neighbor and called Frank at work, telling him to come home early. When Frank got home, he comforted Tina and said he was going to get her professional help, again believing this to all be in her head. Well, I guess the belief of there being a demon that's possessing the house to be in her head, the shaving foam wasn't in her head, it was on the wall. Now, it's important to emphasize that this didn't happen every night, but it happened enough to keep the girls paranoid. Tina would later recount that at one point she got up in the middle of the night and while walking through her house, looked through the darkness, and with a flash of light from outside that Tina said came from a lightning strike in the midst of a storm, she saw the figure of someone sitting at the kitchen table. Finally, in December of 1986, the girls would meet the demon that had been haunting their home. Now, I've heard this part of the story told at least 5 different ways. So again, I'm going with Joe Turner's account, the guy who wrote a book that is a combination of various firsthand accounts. On December the 8th of 1986, Frank, Tina, Karen, and Kathy returned to the house after being out all day. When they arrived home, the house had been trashed. Furniture was pushed across the room, clothes were thrown everywhere. Frank, as you could imagine, blames the girls and asks why they trashed the house, to which the girls say that it was probably the demon. Frank, as you could imagine, became upset at the girls, but the girls said they didn't do it. So Frank walked through the house, throwing open doors and shouting, "Oh, it must have been an intruder then. Come out, come out." And then, as he was sarcastically throwing open doors, he throws open the closet hallway to see a 17-year-old Daniel LaPlante standing there with face paint and a hatchet. This, as you can imagine, caused the whole family to panic as Daniel ordered everyone into the upstairs bedroom. Frank, being unable to stop this as he was unarmed, went with the 3 girls to the upstairs bedroom. As soon as they got into the bedroom, Frank barricaded the door and opened the window so that the girls could escape. Tina ran across the street to the neighbor's house where she called the police. The police arrived, but when they got there, Daniel was nowhere to be found. Now, while the family had seen Daniel before, Daniel again had his face painted and his hair spiked up, and the family didn't recognize him. So when the police got there, the family just said it was some crazed intruder and they didn't know who it could be. So Frank took the girls and went to stay with his eldest daughter who lived in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Now, we don't know for sure why Daniel ordered the family into the upstairs bedroom. If I had to guess, it's so he could have everyone in one place while he ran away. Because even if he did want to kill them, he probably knew that even with a hatchet, he would have a hard time overpowering Frank. And it seems that for the time being, Daniel successfully got away until 2 days later. Because 2 days later, on December the 10th, Frank and the 3 girls decide to go back to the house in order to get some things. Because what are the possibilities of the guy coming back, right? On December the 10th, when Frank pulled into the driveway, he looked in the window of his home and saw someone's face. Frank immediately drove to the neighbor's house and called the police again. When the police arrived, they found that the house was once again vandalized. There was a kitchen knife shoved through a picture of Tina that hung on the wall, and written on the wall in magic marker was the phrase, "I'm still here, come find me." And then on another wall written in magic marker was the phrase, "I'm going to kill you all." While in the basement of the house, one of the officers found a loose wall that led to a partition that hid the plumbing pipes for the house itself. When the officer moved the wall, he saw a giant pile of clothes. As he reached in and tore away some of the clothes, he saw someone's arm hanging out. Quickly, the officers grabbed the arm, ripped whoever it was out of the wall to find Daniel LaPlante holding a wrench. And it was here that Daniel LaPlante was finally arrested after hiding in the Bowen house for a year.
Or, you know, it would have been a year if it started in January, but it actually started in March, so like 9-10 months. Whatever.
Now, there's a ton of myth and urban legends surrounding this case, so to make some of the facts clear, Daniel was not living in the Bowen house exclusively for an entire year. He would come and go from the Bowen house throughout the year. As mentioned, Daniel had a habit of living in people's houses unseen. So when he wanted to, he would go to the Bowen house that was about 8 miles from his own house in Townsend, and by either picking a lock or simply opening an unlocked door, made his way in and out of the house unseen. He would show up for a night, wait for everyone to be asleep, move stuff around, mess with the family, and then leave before he could be discovered. Another myth is that Daniel wasn't living in the walls. Instead, he lived sometimes in a wall. That partition in the basement, as far as we know, is the only place within the interior of the house that he ever hid inside of. Now, it was in the basement of the house, so when Daniel would knock on the wall in the basement, it sounded like it was throughout the walls of the whole house. So it's not like Daniel was moving in between the walls of the girls' bedrooms and things like that. He would just go hide down in the partition, make knocking noises to mess with them, and then leave the partition to do things around the house before going back down there to hide. Some other popular myths is that when Daniel was first discovered, he was dressed as a Native American. I assume this came from the face paint and the hatchet, but otherwise he was just dressed like Daniel. Other instances will say the words that were written on the wall were in ketchup to appear as blood, but as mentioned, it was actually shaving foam. And apparently, whenever the wedding dress was laid out on the bed, he had written "Marry Me" on the wall, or at least some accounts say that he had written "Marry Me" on the wall. And this has led to a more spectacular telling of what happened on December the 8th that says when Frank walked into his bedroom, he saw Daniel standing there in his dead wife's wedding dress with "Marry Me" written on the wall. Also while holding a hatchet. It seems that this case was so popular when it happened and so over the top that people just started getting their creative writing juices out of the way. But again, the version I told is, to my knowledge, the way it took place. For a year, Daniel would break into the Bowen house and torment this family. But at least now, he was arrested. When he was arrested for breaking into the Bowen home, the officer that arrested him said that he took 10 mugshots because he knew he would need these pictures again. Just something about Daniel told the cop that this kid was going to be trouble. His charges were breaking and entering and attempted aggravated assault. While he definitely should have also got a stalking charge, I guess it was hard for the prosecution to argue that, as there wasn't like documented evidence with the police of this happening beforehand, because again, Frank just assumed all this to be a trick that the girls were playing, and the girls believed it to be the devil. So since he was 17, Daniel was being held in a juvenile detention center, and the prosecution wanted to try him as an adult. His original defense attorney in this case was a man named Andrew Gustafson, but for reasons we don't know, Daniel fired Andrew and hired another attorney. Now, while we know with hindsight that Daniel was an incredibly violent and dangerous individual from all the accounts that would come out in the years to follow, at the time, the only thing the courts knew of was this single breaking and entering event. And despite this event being disturbing, I suppose they chalked it up to the mind of a crazed teenager. So when the opportunity became available after spending 10 months in juvie, Daniel's mother, Elaine, posted his bail in October of 1987, with his court date set for 2 months later on December 11th. As soon as Daniel got back into his mother's custody, he began to do the same things he was doing before he was in police custody. He broke into multiple people's houses and in November stole 2 guns from a house he broke into. His stepfather found these guns and asked Daniel about it, who said he bought them from a friend. Despite the tragic number of chances people had to stop Daniel, no one did, and the consequences of that would be made known on December the 1st of 1987. Behind Daniel's home was a large patch of woods, and several of the houses in the area backed up to these woods. About half a mile through the trees was the Gustafson home, the same home of Andrew Gustafson, Daniel's original lawyer for the Bowen case. Now, it seems that the Gustafsons had suspected that someone had broken into their home prior to December 1st, as in November, there seemed to be signs of things within the house being moved around, meaning that, again, given his MO, Daniel had probably broken into the house previously. Andrew and his wife Priscilla, who was 33 years old and pregnant that December, lived in the house with their 5-year-old son William and their 8-year-old daughter Abigail. According to forensics, the following series of events happened on December the 1st. And again, viewer discretion is advised. While Andrew was at work, Daniel broke into the house and held Priscilla at gunpoint. He tied Priscilla face down to her bed and then filled up the bathtubs in the upstairs and downstairs bathroom and then drowned both of the Gustafson children, one in each bathtub. The reason he did this was probably to lead one away from the other so they wouldn't see what was about to happen to them. After killing the children, he then went back to Priscilla, who he violently assaulted, along with several pages of pornographic magazines that he had brought with him and condoms. After this, he used a pillow to suppress the sound and fired several shots into her head. It seems that during this, he just used things that were in the house, like opening a beer he found in the fridge, and then left the house, only for Andrew to walk in and find the massacre a few hours later. Andrew walked into his home and wondered why it was suspiciously quiet, only to go to his bedroom and see his wife's body on the bed. He then left the house, went to the neighbor, and called the police. Later in court, Andrew was asked why he didn't go looking for his kids after finding his wife's body. And he said it's because he knew they were already dead. There were so many steps along the way where the system kept failing. If maybe when the first girl went to the police and said that Daniel a couple years earlier had assaulted her, maybe if they took her seriously and arrested him, that would have at least been on his record for when he got arrested for breaking and entering. And then maybe they would have taken the case more seriously. Maybe they would have tried him as an adult. Maybe they wouldn't have given him this 2-month window of bail that he needed to commit this heinous crime. But because too many opportunities were given to him along the way, it led to the tragic end of Priscilla, her 2 children, and her unborn child. After the murders, Daniel ran away from the Gustafson house through the woods back to his own house. In the search that would follow, it would later be found that Daniel ditched some of his clothes in the woods between the 2 homes, as some of his clothing was wet, seemingly from the bathtubs. The night that the crime happened, there were 2 people in town that the police suspected. One of them, of course, was Daniel. The police went to his house, asked him where he was, he gave some excuse, and then they left. It seemed that whoever the other suspect was, that guy had an alibi, so the police got a warrant to search Daniel's home. As the police approach Daniel's home, they see him jump out of the side of the house and make a run for it, which led to a statewide manhunt for 2 days. Daniel's face was all over the news, the newspapers, every cop in the state was looking for him. Someone recognized him in town and then called the police. When the police got there, he had just gotten away. At one point, he broke into someone's house and switched out his coat for their coat, I guess because he figured the person who saw him earlier probably saw what he was wearing, so he needed to change his outfit. Daniel had taken 1 of the 2 guns that he had previously stolen with him. So he uses this gun to hijack a woman driving a van. He gets in the car and holds her at gunpoint and makes her drive him to the next town over. At some point during this, the woman jumps out of the van and runs away. I guess Daniel didn't know how to drive a car, which would make sense considering he just took his bicycle everywhere. Or he figured that the police would be on a lookout for that van specifically because, you know, the woman who was driving it just ran away and is probably going to tell someone about it. So Daniel continues his run on foot. The police assumed that he was probably going to catch a train, so all train stations in the area were being monitored and searches conducted around them. Since assuming he can't get a car, a train is going to be his quickest means of escape. So on December the 4th, 2 days after Daniel had made his run for it, the police search a lumberyard located next to a train station. And while searching this lumberyard, sure enough, they found Daniel in an empty shack at the back of the property. This shack was like a worker's quarters for people who were working at the lumberyard. Funny enough, next to the shack was a big dumpster, which led a bunch of outlets to report that Daniel was found hiding in a trash can, which is more fitting, I think. So finally, on December the 4th, Daniel was arrested and the manhunt came to an end. Now, Daniel was caught dead to rights as anyone could be. All of the condoms from the Gustafson house were filled with his DNA. The pornographic magazine pages that he had torn out and left at the Gustafson house for some reason. The rest of the magazine was found back at his house. The wet clothes that were found in the woods connecting the 2 houses were later found to be Daniel's. The other pistol, the one he used to murder Priscilla, was found in the glove box of a car at his house. And quite poetically, one of the hairs of 8-year-old Abigail Gustafson was found on his sock. A piece of the life he ended, making sure he wouldn't get to live out his. Also, you know, running from police and hijacking cars doesn't help. Because of this, his defensive strategy was to just argue technicality. For example, the original warrant that the police had signed on December the 2nd to come investigate Daniel before Daniel took off. In the warrant, the police had identified the house as a single-family residence, and the defense argued that it is a split-level home. And since Daniel was his own resident, or like almost an adult, I guess. So since the property was actually a 2-family home instead of a 1-family home, everything that came because of that warrant should be thrown out. The judge rightfully said, that's stupid, in more, you know, legal appropriate words, noting that the house has 1 address and 1 primary entrance and everyone that lives there is related to each other, so single family's fine. After this, the argument the defense tried to go with is that none of the evidence points towards Daniel being the only perpetrator of the crime, and instead it could have been a group of people and Daniel is simply taking the fall for it, kind of implying that he was dragged along by this other group of mystery people and was actually just a witness to the crimes. You would think if this was the case, Daniel may say who did it, but whatever. And then also, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not an expert on this thing, but there was an argument made by the defense that said the nature of the crime indicates insanity, which is like a weird backup plan. Because they're like, look, the warrant was wrong. Nothing that came out of that warrant should be allowed. Okay, it is allowed. Well, how do we even know that Daniel was alone? It could have been like, you know, a dozen people. Maybe he was just like outside and was watching. And also, hypothetically, if he were to do it, which I'm not saying, that would be the insanity defense, I think. Yeah. Despite this, Daniel was found guilty of all three murders at the Gustafson home and sentenced to three life sentences in prison. Funny enough, this means that he never got tried for the original breaking and entering and attempted aggravated assault charges, and the comparatively minor stuff like holding the woman at gunpoint to steal her car or evading arrest. Because again, he got three life sentences, so the rest doesn't really matter. And from there, Daniel has thankfully remained in prison. And it's pretty apparent that he's not happy about it. In 2012, the Supreme Court made some rulings to try to get parole opportunities for juvenile offenders who were sentenced to life sentences. And while Massachusetts followed suit with this, there was a clause that especially heinous crimes don't count. So when Daniel applied for early parole, he was immediately shut down. Especially considering psychiatrists that have spoken to him since have said that he shows no remorse for the crime and should stay in there. He constantly files complaints against the justice system and against the prisons that he's being held in. For a while, he said that he was a Satanist and that the prison's not allowing him the things that he needs to perform his satanic rituals is a form of religious discrimination. At another point, he said he was trying to study law, and the prison's not giving him enough time in the library was, again, discriminatory. Funny enough, for a while, he got moved from Massachusetts to Colorado, I believe, because in Massachusetts, he believed he was going to be murdered by the other inmates, which is likely considering child murderers are viewed pretty lowly in most prison populations. And Daniel will first be eligible for parole in 2033 when he is 62 years old. But according to everyone in power at the moment, that's not going to happen. And that guy is going to die in there. And with that, we have the end of the story of Daniel LaPlante, or the boy who lived in the walls. I mean, what's there to say about it? I always try to be careful when I cover topics like this, because at the end of the day, it was lives that were snuffed out, and regardless of the spectacular nature of the crime, I don't want it to lose the fact that this is a very evil person who did very evil things. According to Joe Turner, several women still write Daniel letters and claim to be his girlfriend who are obsessed with this serial killer bad boy who's locked up. So I don't mean any of this to romanticize or make a spectacle out of a tragic death. Instead, just to give a tale of how terrifying and strange the world can be. And while enjoyable may not be the right word, I hope you at least found some of this interesting. And I really appreciate it, and I just want to say thank you for watching. Talking to Joe Turner, there are so many things about this case that are so weird, so many like local legends and stories. There's one belief that Andrew Gustafson actually paid Daniel to kill his family, and the only evidence of that is that he remarried 8 months later. Which, like, okay, that doesn't mean that he paid this kid to murder his family. Also, if that was the case, then don't you think Daniel would have said something about it? Like, why would Daniel, like, have this sudden loyalty to a guy who paid him to murder his whole family? Like, it's absurd. But there's, like, weird stories like that. According to Joe, about a year after Daniel was arrested, he attempted a breakout that almost worked.
Also, didn't really have an area to casually mention this, but the house Daniel LaPlante lived on was 22 Elm Street. So he was literally a nightmare from Elm Street.
But all of those are details he's saving for his book. So again, I'll link Joe Turner's website in the description. be sure to follow him and check it out whenever the book and documentary comes out, because he is going to have a lot of stuff in there that I don't even know about, let alone covered. But he was incredibly kind to provide his information, as well as some of the images you've seen in this video. So it certainly does mean the world, and I really appreciate not only people who are cool enough to learn about these things, document them, but are cool enough to share that information with YouTubers, because it is much better than the alternative, I can tell you that. But no, thank you guys so much for watching. Again, we have the merch that's available for like a week, maybe not even that, maybe just a few more days. Get in all on it while you can at wendigoon.shop, linked in the description. Some more content coming for you all on the second channel, Wendigang, very soon, so stay tuned for that. But I believe that should do it for now. But I just want to say thank you for watching. I hope that you enjoyed, and I will see you in the next one. Bye!